This sounds kind of lame, but I always wanted to work for the government. We had over 45,000 users across the applications that had been built. So it was really exciting. And so it's hard to sometimes roll the punches, but there's nothing like being able to make a real life impact on somebody. And the government has such a far reach of capability. There's always a way that you can make an impact.
I'm Rachel Coble.
And I'm Liz Dean.
Welcome to Mock It. This podcast interviews industry experts from AI innovators to UX architects to nonprofit leaders and lots of people in between.
We explore the back of the napkin ideas that impact the nation so you don't have to dig for the discoveries yourself. Enjoy and don't forget to like and subscribe. So for today's episode, we're going to be talking to Hannah Hunt, who is a distinguished technical fellow at MetroStar. Again, this is one of our fun episodes where we veer off topic a little bit. We talk about Harry Potter, Taylor Swift, government innovation, and startups.
Yes, how all of those things intertwine, you'll just have to listen to figure out. And you'll even learn what Hannah's era is. If you're a Swiftie, you know what I mean.
This sounds kind of lame, but I always wanted to work for the government. Like, I was in third grade when 9/11 happened. And so my dad worked in Manhattan at the time, and he was supposed to go to the World Trade Center for like a meeting that was like later in the day. And so like it just kind of affected my entire family. And living in, we lived in Connecticut at the time, like it was everything. And I just got really interested in our response to it, the, you know, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I was like, I want to understand these people and like why they think the way that they do and the behaviors that they have. And like, this was the one I was like in like sixth grade. And I was like, I want to work for the government. I want to work for the State Department. Like, I want to like help channel diplomacy and like build better rapport with the US and like other countries. And so that was always like my North Star. And so I don't have technically a tech background, but I went to American University in DC and I got my bachelor's and my master's in international affairs. My first real job was at the State Department. And I had other internships at some NGOs and nonprofits and at the Treasury Department, but I always wanted that like State Department job. And so that was my first real look at like being in the government. I was a GS5, making like $35,000 a year in DC. It was a tough life initially, but just fell in love kind of with the government, with the State Department. And eventually moved over to the DoD and started doing some corporate communications, public affairs, strategic initiatives type of work. And that kind of parlayed me into working with some of the acquisition programs within the Army. I supported a couple of acquisition programs, and I learned about government contracting and how do you procure services and systems and what does that look like. And I'd always been looking for like a real federal job. I was a contractor. And so I kind of was applying around to different positions. I was going to join the Foreign Service with the State Department, but there was at the time an 18-month hiring freeze. And so nobody was getting hired. And I decided maybe it's best to stay stateside. And so I was applying in the IC and just like pretty much any like federal position. I had an old coworker who was working at this really cool software organization in the Air Force called Kessel Run. And she's like, hey, they're doing this big hiring event. Like you should, apply. And I was like, okay. And then I got an interview like the next day and they hired me in like a month, which is really fast for the government. And so I joined their BizOps team, that the acquisitions team, and started working on different like agile contracts and agile acquisitions. And being part of a software organization, I naturally gained a lot of information around software and how the government procures it, but also how to build it, what types of skill sets you need, what type of technologies. And so I wanted to be more engaged in the tech. Within my first 6 months, I got promoted to being the chief of staff of the organization, which is about 14. At the time, we scaled to about 1,400 people, and it was the first chief of staff there. I did a lot of like organizational change management, HR, manpower things, but I really loved the technology, especially like the platform work and things like that. So when I was looking to leave, I found a new organization that was standing up in the Army and got connected with the directors there and was like, hey, I'll like come join you. I'll come travel to I'll move to Austin, Texas. Like, you know, part of this kind of startup within the Army about training soldiers on how to build software, really just like an awesome mission and program. And I got into the tech role that I really wanted, which is I was the chief of product over there, but also led the platform effort. And so, yeah, that's kind of been like my career path, starting from a very non-tech background to like where I am today. It's kind of cool. There's this really good book by David Epstein called Range. And the general thesis of the book is that people who have a larger breadth and depth of experience are going to have better outcomes than somebody who's super specialized. And so I've felt that's very aligned with like how my career has progressed.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. And I feel like it's not often that you hear someone that knew what they wanted at such a young age and they actually went and did was in that industry. So even though you've done a bunch of different roles, it's nice to hear that you stayed in the industry that you always were interested in.
Yeah, I didn't know at the time what was available in the government because it's really just not.
They don't talk about it really. Like you don't. I when I graduated college, I mean, maybe this says more about me than other people, but I didn't even really know what government contracting was or like, well, like what a company like MetroStar does or things like that. So I feel like they need to be better about telling the world what it is.
That's a good segue for, so, okay, you did Kessel Run and then you did another organization within the government. Can you give a little bit more insight exactly to that? Is it a company that, How does a company within the government work? Like, who are you, a federal employee? Are you sort of like how a nonprofit within the government works?
Yeah. So I, at Kessel Run, I was a government civilian, a federal employee and moved up the ranks pretty quickly. And then when I left Kessel Run, I went to the Army Software Factory, which as still is a government employee, or they call them Department of the Army Civilians. I don't know. We had basically been given this seed money to experiment and prototype model.
Cool. Yeah, that's really cool.
And it really wasn't, there was this avail, like this bucket of money that people could leverage. And so we were able to demonstrate like that we could use some of that money. And it's pretty abnormal, actually. A lot of the software factories across the department typically come from acquisition programs that already have a set budget. They're just revolutionizing the way that software is being developed, typically with the government serving in the lead versus a contract company. So this Army Software Factory effort is not tied to an acquisition program. It sat within a non-acquisition organization, Army Futures Command, which is prepping for the future of war. And so it was really like a neat and novel concept because a lot of those other software factories don't. We weren't constrained like the other software factories. So the model at the Army Software Factory is that every 6 months, we were bringing in soldiers from various different backgrounds and ranks and teaching them what it means to build software across a variety of roles we have here at MetroStar, like product management, design, software engineering, platform engineering. And so gaining some level of upskilling there in an academic portion. And then my job was to find problems for them to solve. And so I kind of had a mechanism of which to receive and evaluate problems that we could turn into products that would provide value to other soldiers or users across the Army. And so that was a really fun job because I got to learn about a lot of different domains and identify, you know, really niche or hard problems that like soldiers could deliver software against. And that we, at the time before I left a few months ago, we had over 45,000 users across the applications that had been built. So it was really exciting. We've got like tons of traction and there's tons of value add for the soldiers that learn how to build the software and then actually built it and deployed it.
Wow.
That's amazing. I was just thinking like 45,000 people. I mean, how do you interject with like product management and then user experience and they're your customers as well. So how did you manage all of those hats while still doing a very important job of protecting the country?
I worked with some of the smartest people I think I've ever worked with. Definitely did not do it alone. We started off with a very small team and kind of slapstick some stuff together. I mean, it sounds really easy, but it was really hard. Like we just had some very rudimentary processes. And then as we scaled, we had to then scale those processes. And so all of our soldiers, you know, we had soldier product managers, designers, engineers, and they were the ones, you know, building the software. My job was to make sure that they were actually building the right thing. And so I implemented a process in the organization called growth boards. It comes out of Eric Ries's book, The Startup Way, which is the follow-on to his book, The Lean Startup. And we talk a lot about lean product management. And that's like how much of a small increment of value can you deliver? Very uncomfortable concept for the government. That's the best way to deliver software is these like small increments, fully functioning pieces of software. And so he documented this process that venture capital uses when they review all their portfolios of products, whatever, you know, on whatever cadence they have. There's a set of criteria, how they measure value. And then every quarter or a year, they look across their portfolio of products and venture capital say, hey, I'm going to divest resources here, or I'm going to invest more resources in this company because, you know, their revenue's doing much better. And so it's hard in the government when you're not profit driven to define what value is. And so we, you know, have many types of value, user value, technology value. Is there a new technology approach that we're leveraging? Strategic value for the Army, strategic value for the software factory itself. And so every quarter, all the applications would go through this growth board review and basically be evaluated if they were meeting their intended outcomes and their goals and the metrics that they were using to ensure that they did meet those outcomes and goals. And then if they didn't, we canceled them. We turned them off. It's the first time I've seen growth boards be implemented in the government effectively. I've used them at Kessel Run a little bit, but everything was always just like, keep going, persevere. And we were like, no, like we're done, punt. Like, hey, like you delivered value, but you met the need. And move on. And it wasn't anything personal. It was just the nature of that product lifecycle, or maybe they couldn't get engaged with their user base. And so there was no reason to keep going. That's one of the greatest, like one of my coolest things that I've been able to do is to build that model.
Oh, that is so cool. I mean, you're talking a lot about startups like within government. What would be your advice to someone who, say, was coming out of college or doing a career shift and they were trying to decide if they wanted to do a startup like typical like Valley startup, San Fran, or government? Like, what do you think are the pros and cons between either? What would you ultimately pick?
You can get venture capital money pretty easily. I know a couple of people have left the government and like been able to get venture capital money like pretty fast. I don't know how that world works at all.
Me either.
That sounds pretty lucrative. I think the coolest part of doing something new in the government is that while there are detractors and it can be fatiguing, like you can actually make a real impact on the way that the Defense Department or whatever agency is actually doing business. And so it can be a slog sometimes, but I think making incremental changes is hugely valuable and definitely needed. And it can be demoralizing at times, which is part of the reason I left the government, is just getting really fatigued with the bureaucracy fighting and needed to just step away. But there's also great wins and like good and value that's delivered. And so it's hard to sometimes roll with the punches, but there's nothing like being able to make a real life impact on somebody. And the government has such a far reach of capability. There's always a way that you can make an impact.
How did you guys decipher what your wins would be considered? So when you're talking a little bit ago, you know, you guys are pretty cutthroat. Like, this isn't working. Out the door.
I love it.
Like, wow, that's so stressful. Like, how would you decide on that versus, you know, is it stakeholders? Was it users? Was it a combination of both? Was it, you know, who is seeding the money?
Yeah, it was, we were essentially funded. So in the sense that we had our own budget, we weren't receiving funds from other people. So we could do with the money the way that we wanted to, which was nice. But yeah, I mean, a great example is we were delivering a product to a customer or, you know, a user base, a stakeholder, and they, we could not get traction with the user base. They were constantly, the unit was constantly rotating or going and getting deployed. And so it was near impossible to just get any type of feedback on the product. And the soldiers, you know, this product team worked for about a year, like attempting to find new user bases and customers that wanted to leverage this. And at the end of the day, they really couldn't get the right numbers that would make it worthwhile based on the target market. And so we said, okay, well, you know, like we'll keep this available for people if they want to use it, but we're not going to invest more resources in new features or like more design updates or anything like that. And so we weren't just kind of, it's hard. Sometimes we're all or nothing. We're like, okay, we're done. But other times we kept the product available, but didn't do any additional development on it.
How does what you've done before and kind of that almost kind of fast-paced yes, no environment, what is that like at MetroStar in your new technical role? Like what encompasses your role at MetroStar and how does it differ from what you've been doing? Or is it similar?
It's kind of a hodgepodge role.
Love those roles.
Yeah. That's how we ended up here.
I really enjoy the flexibility to kind of decide what I want to work on. And I had some of that at my previous roles too. And I did a lot of different things. Like in addition to all the product work, I also did our acquisitions and our contracting. And so it was a lot. And here I try to direct my energy to where I can provide the most value, whether that is delivery with an existing customer or program that we're supporting, or with growth opportunities where we need to find the right teaming partners or solutions that we're going to develop against, or even more at a strategic level of like organizationally, like how do we want to align ourselves? How do we want to posture ourselves? And so I have a lot of flexibility on where I think I should invest my time, but I'm doing a bunch of different things with a bunch of different customers. But I actually really enjoy that. My biggest like fatal flaw is I say yes to too much because I get excited and I want to support and then I burn myself out. And so I'm really, really trying for this position and this role that I really do enjoy not to do that because I don't want to get burnout. I really like this. Oh. So like, I'm just kind of have to keep measuring and, you know, setting boundaries and saying, you know, help me prioritize what's most important.
That's such a good skill. That's also something I definitely struggle with in my personal and professional life.
I feel like our generation is like trying to find
just
the boundary generation.
Generational curse.
No, it super is.
Some of the work you've done at MetroStar, and you recently published a blog post at MetroStar as well as a LinkedIn post as well on data as a product, which I think is so interesting. And it seems like one of those things that's like, why didn't I think of it this way before? But when you read it, it's like really interesting to learn about. Can you give us an overview of what does data as a product mean and why is it crucial for organizations to understand it?
Yeah. I definitely didn't invent the concept. caveat that. But in general, you can treat pretty much anything as a product. And when I say that, it means that there is some stakeholder, or some user base that, my cord just fell, some stakeholder or user base that has a need and some service, offering, application, data product can help to solve that problem. So instead of it looking like a technology, you know, technologies for technology's sake, there's some form of outcome that we're trying to generate. And with data, there are typically kind of two types of data. You've got your analytical data. This is kind of giving you insights into uptime, number of users, reliability, things along those lines, which will give insights into the business of like how well your product's doing. And then there's more of the operational data. And this is the stuff that's being generated by the user themselves. The example sometimes that I use, so I'm a big Swiftie. So Spotify, like Spotify has made playlists for me of Taylor Swift, you know, mixes, things solid. Like that, because I listen to Taylor Swift so much. They've got this analytical data on me that I am like, you know, number of times I've listened to the same song or number of times I've like searched for Taylor Swift or whatever. So that's information that Spotify can use to improve my experience. And then I can make my own playlists and I can generate my own content within Spotify that, you know, improves my user experience. I can make my own playlist or I can, you know, hide things that I'm not interested in. And so it's like a very like basic example of what data as a product can do. Then you can take that information and make insights or optimize things or, you know, whatever the flavor is that you need to do with the information.
I love that data scientists everywhere are like, woo. But before we move on to any more about data as a product, I must ask the most important question. What Taylor Swift era is your favorite era?
Oh gosh. So my husband's a Swiftie too. So we've debated this a few times. I don't like that she like lost her country drawl in the new Taylor's releases, but I'll accept that. I get it. I think I'm a Red fan. I think
that's a good choice. I think I might be too.
I definitely listened to 1989 Taylor's version on the way in today because I
was sticking with it.
So
always Taylor's version.
My wife is a huge Swiftie, like an OG Swiftie, Swiftie by marriage, and so I like the pop eras of the you know, every like 1989 was like my like first true intro into
same,
her.
Same.
So like I love her Taylor's version 1989.
I agree. I wasn't into the country era because I'm from West Virginia. And for some reason, I had a vendetta against anything country related because I was like, I'm a city girl in the middle of West Virginia. I won't listen to any country. And then she came out with pop albums and I was like, yes. But yeah, I'm a Red girl too. So thank you for that. That was important information.
That was a very good question.
I think it's when she like matures in her music is yes. Kind of the way that I have experienced it. I got to see her when she was in Texas, like just that happenstance. I had a coworker who was selling tickets that he had gotten, like extra tickets. And I was like walking in the hallway and he was like, do you want these? And I was like, yes, I do.
Oh my gosh.
It was amazing.
Her Eras concert was, I was blown away.
You went to it too?
Yeah. I got, that was Erin's her only Christmas present last year.
Man, now I'm mad at everyone who didn't get me Eras tickets, knowing that I don't actually really like concerts, but I'm like, oh man.
It's an experience. Like I go see the movie, you know.
Oh, that's true. I should go see the movie.
So I would love to turn this into a Swiftie podcast. I think Rachel and I would do very well as Swiftie podcasters. But I do have a data question for you. For those that might be a little bit intimidated by data science or don't think they have the skill set or maybe don't, you know, have a data scientist handy on their team, what tips do you have for a normal person who wants to decipher data as a product but doesn't
have the resources to have someone really good at it do it for them?
Or Spotify.
So that's a great question. There's a lot of low code or no code products out there that if you want to build dashboards or like generate insights, they make it pretty easy and kind of streamlined. You don't need to code in Python to be able to do it. Like even some of the stuff that we've built within MetroStar, like our labeling product, LabelUp, like that is a low code like solution. Like it, it's meant to be a seamless user experience. And so there's plenty of those out there that don't require significant engineering skills. I mean, I'm not an engineer, so I really take more of a product approach and then let like the data scientists of the world do the actual development. But they're very complementary because the data science, especially for data science and machine learning, there needs to be a use case that you're trying to gain insights to and in order to deliver some form of optimization. And so that ties really closely with product management, where the whole role of product management is to generate those outcomes and those insights to be able to improve whatever user experience or stakeholder needs. So they're very complementary. Just one skill set is more engineering and the other is more like writing stories, users, map, roadmaps, et cetera.
Low code, no code is so interesting to me. And the only way I can think about it is MySpace, to be honest.
Like, so you know, they used to Zynga growing up, because I learned how to code HTML on Zynga.
Oh, the past two episodes, all we've done is talk about Taylor Swift and MySpace, but I feel like we are missing a whole generation of little mini coders because there's no MySpace, or it's just like intuitive on all the social media apps now. But do you think that low code, no code would ever, like, maybe, I mean, like, want them to make their own social media and then have everyone code like their own thing so we can all like learn fun coding?
They're teaching coding in schools now. Like, we didn't get that when we were growing up. We had to like figure it out.
Learn cursive.
Yeah. Like, I remember learning, I learned HTML so I could like make awesome backgrounds. But I think kids are like, my niece is 7. And so she's learning, you know, how to code in school. Like, it's just like a thing in the curriculum now that we didn't have, but it seems very commonplace now.
That's so crazy, because I feel like technology is making a lot of things easier and harder, but easier for people that aren't writers necessarily to get a little content from ChatGPT or another generative AI source, or low code, no code is making it easier for someone who's not like a developer or coder to create things. What do you think across all of these roles, especially since you are someone who's had a lot of roles in your life, what do you think is like an underlying skill that you think is needed across all of these types of jobs and capabilities?
That's a great question. Yeah, I don't think it's a hard skill necessarily. I think it's more soft skills, like curiosity, like eagerness to learn, growth mindset, because then you'll be interested in learning about these things and gaining a perspective. Like, I really wasn't a ChatGPT person because I'm an elitist. I don't know. Like, write my own stuff. I don't need generative AI. And then it's helped me on, you know, several occasions. And I think it's just about being curious. I do a lot of research on my own. I try to understand why things are the way they are, how architectures are set up. That's what really got me interested in like platform as a service and those types of product offerings, because everything underlining what you see from a user perspective, there's like a bunch of guts on the back end. And how do you make that a seamless experience from a developer perspective or whatever? So my curiosity has enabled me, I think, to like be in a variety of different roles and to learn a lot of different information. And so curiosity, I think, is just the most important like soft skill to have.
Do you have any, it seems you read a lot and you research a lot, you're very curious. Do you have any like books you would suggest for people to maybe read, or magazine subscriptions that you like? I feel like this question would put me on the spot, but I feel like you would be able to answer this just from you being able to rattle off some of the book titles you've already done so far.
Yeah, so I mentioned this, the Lean Startup by Eric Ries. That is like the Bible of like lean product management. So definitely recommend. I talked about Range. There's this really great book about, there's this like coach in Silicon Valley. It's called Million Dollar Coach. And he was like tech coach to all these different CEOs. And it's a great read. I've finished it recently. The DevOps handbook, and the Unicorn Project, are all like great, like DevOps flavored books.
Yeah, I did not mean to put you on the spot.
That was already a lot. Yeah.
You're becoming a manager for the first time. When I became a manager, when I became chief of staff, I inherited like 50 direct reports and I was like 26. And I was like, don't know how to manage people. Like, and there was this book by Julie Zhao, who's the former head of design at Facebook. She wrote a book called Making of a Manager. And it is like the premise is, hey, you just became a manager accidentally. Like, here's what you need to know to be a manager. And it's so helpful. It was so helpful to me. So I always recommend that for new managers. And then I'm a huge Harry Potter fan. So you can always reread the books like I do every year.
Oh, yeah. I just read Harry Potter for the first time last year. So
never read it.
First time? That's a shame.
Listen, I know it's even worse because I'm a very avid reader, like hit like at least 50 books a year, 52 books a year. And all of my friends were judging me so hard. So my book club, which is just me and my friends, we were like, we're going to read all the Harry Potter books.
That's awesome.
It was really good. I was kind of annoyed about how good they were because I've been on a pedestal forever being like, they're not going to be as good as everyone says they are. And then I was like,
damn. They're pretty great.
They're pretty good.
Yeah, I have not read Harry Potter, but I feel like being a mom, I'm going to have to.
So my nieces are reading it right now for the first time, but they had to stop because they got to Goblet of Fire and it got too scary. So they're going to repick it back
scary.
Up.
Goblet of Fire is intense.
Yeah,
I get it.
Like a third or fourth. Like, when do I need to stop reading to, like, well, I mean, I will not initiate the reading, but if and when my baby wants to read these, when do I need to be like, you can't read this one until you're older?
Probably Goblet of Fire. Like,
that's when it starts.
The first two books are like the most child books, I would say. I just got the
characters start getting offed in Goblet of Fire. If that tells you anything.
Okay, yeah. So the first two books are safe, and then
That's the first time where I was like, no. This is a major spoiler, but I was like, Robert Pattinson, no.
Is that a spoiler? That movie came out like...
That's true. I do live by the fact that if movies have been out for a really long time, you can't
spoil it. I didn't
even
know he was in it.
Oh, yeah. He plays this character called Cedric Diggory. He's like young, pre-Twilight.
Yeah, pre-Twilight.
I didn't even know.
Oh, man. Mm.
This is also terrible.
Is my favorite movie. It's my favorite of the...
It's a good one. The book was really good. I liked the book Goblet of Fire was really intense. Wow, this podcast got real. People are going to be like, oh, okay.
Pretty much every podcast I do, we talk about Harry Potter at some point. So
I love that. Do you have any Harry Potter tattoos? I feel like some people...
I do.
My sister-in-law.
Managed on my shoulder.
I love that.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's even worse because my sister-in-law is a huge Harry Potter fan and has the Harry Potter lightning bolt.
She has a lightning bolt on her forehead?
Not on her forehead, but it's on.
I was like, now that is dedication. No,
she doesn't have it on her forehead, but she has, I think, the lightning bolt tattooed on her.
Oh, I like that. So fun. I get nervous about getting tattoos for books. Like, I'm so nervous to get tattoos that are based off of anyone famous because I'm like, oh no, what if they do? I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
But I do. You should read them.
We'll see. Well, I'm still on my pedestal.
Just so you can be a part of a pop culture moment, honestly.
I feel at my age, though, I'm like, I already missed the boat to be like in my generation.
I read them just as fast.
That's true.
What do you think is the Harry Potter of government? Like, what is, like, something that everybody is obsessed with in the government space that is good to be obsessed with? Whether it be, like, I feel like right now it's probably customer experience, but, like, what is that?
There's been a big customer experience push. Like, every agency is hiring, like, a chief experience officer. AI and ML are obviously the big fad tour du jour, whatever, of the day.
Yeah. It's a little stressful, to be honest. I'm just worried we're going to do it wrong. What are your fears when it comes to AI and government?
I think that we're not anywhere near the ability to do any of the scary things that people say.
Oh, I love that.
It's laughable, I guess. Maybe not intelligence community. We're doing cool stuff. I don't know. I don't have this, I'm not read in on this.
As a non-cleared person, I think that,
Yeah. I'm not part of that crew, but I will say that we can't even get data on like parts. in like how we need to order parts for vehicles. It's stuff that's handwritten on a form that like then is uploaded into a system. Like, we're not even at the stage where we could optimize that data at scale, right? We're able to do these kind of smaller efforts and be able to pull some data from that. But like the data needs to be cleaned. It needs to be consumable in a way to be able to even do this optimization. So like writ large, like the, especially in the DoD, like we're not even close. And like what we're trying to do, obviously at MetroStar, is to get the government like that much closer to being able to do some of these things
in an ethical way.
This makes me feel much better with what you're saying, because sometimes I get interview with a spy pops up on my social media, and then one of the questions she always asks is, if people knew what you knew, would people be more afraid or less afraid? And everyone's like, way more afraid. So I'm like, oh my God, we're going to die.
That's such a rude answer. I feel like a good government person would be like, oh no, don't be afraid.
Public service, you're safe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there obviously is like drones and stuff like that. And there are safeguards in place, but at full scale, full autonomous drones shooting people, like, we don't have accuracy there. Like, it's just...
No iRobot situation happening.
I was just my mind about iRobot.
Yeah, I've actually never seen that movie.
Oh, that's a good... It's a good movie. You should watch it.
Okay. Yeah, it's got a young Shia LaBeouf in it as well, which I always do.
That... It doesn't have... what's his name? Will Smith?
Yeah, it's Will Smith.
Isn't there like a dog? Or is that I Am Legend?
That's the other one.
Okay. Yeah. That's why I've been putting off iRobot, because I was like, I think there's a dog scene that I really don't want to see.
Different movie.
Okay.
Same premise, different
movie. That's why Will Smith was like, I'm just going to sign up for all of these.
That's why I won't watch that. Was it John Wick? Is it John Wick with Keanu Reeves? There's something about a dog, and I know I don't want to watch it.
Oh, I think that's the entire premise of John Wick. I think he goes on this rampage because of his dog.
Yeah, and I don't want to watch whatever scene that, because I love my dog very much. I respect that. Yeah. I guess that's too intense for me.
Once again, back to government. So can you talk about how important it is to join a company that matches your culture? I know that I've been reading a few of your things, and it seems like you're always very sad to leave the places that you've been or like transition. Like, what's your advice to someone? Like, how do you know when you should transition, even if you really like your company? And like, what should you look for in your next company?
Yeah, culture is everything. And actually, like, your boss is everything.
Yes.
Like, having the right boss, it will make or break anything. Because even if the company isn't necessarily driving, if you've got a good boss, like, that is like the more important. And that's been my like experience in all the roles that I've had. I value certain things what in organizations I work for. I want to have, you know, autonomy, not like going off on my own, but being able to take initiative and help to deliver and make decisions. I want to have opportunities for growth for myself. I don't want to be tapped out. I want a company that is willing to take risks and make mistakes and pivot and be flexible, and a company that cares about its people. And so, as I've changed roles throughout my time in the government, I've been kind of looking for these things. And some of it's very hard, because especially with bureaucracy, is that it like crushes you down, and like it's outside of the organization's control some of the time. And that makes it like even more painful that you can't solve it. And I got to a point in my last role where I kept getting beat down trying to deliver value to the Army, and just I just couldn't really take it anymore. And when I was looking for different opportunities, I fell in love with MetroStar's culture. I really valued all the things that I just listed are things that MetroStar espouses, and you know, now working here actually like implements. And so I'm really glad I made the shift over here, because I do feel like I do have autonomy. I do feel like I have opportunities for growth. I do feel like this is an organization that is willing to change and take advice and get and have feedback and improve and iterate. So like everything checks the box for me.
Yeah, I love that. Well, we're glad you're here too. I know I've been working on you with you for some pages that are coming to MetroStar very soon. And I was reading your feedback today, and it was very helpful. So very happy to have you here.
Glad to help.
So as we kind of start to wrap up our time with you, like, you're very cool. You have a lot of wisdom to share. Where can people find you? Where can they subscribe to you? Where can they learn from you?
I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. So you find me, Hannah Hunt, on LinkedIn. It's where I post primarily. I sometimes write long posts. Sometimes I post memes. I like to do these types of like podcasts and talks and things. So I'm hoping to do like more of those. But yeah, you'll find me mostly on LinkedIn.
Awesome. And you just recently did another podcast, correct?
Yes, I did. I did Be the Reason with Mohawk Matt. And that was fun. That was my first podcast post-government. I got to be a little spicy. So
yay!
Something to know about me is I live my life on a spicy scale. And so I've successfully implemented it at two organizations now. One in my last job at Army Sulphur Factory and now here, which is really exciting. So from a spice level, you've got 1 to 5 peppers. So this is like a 2 spicy, or this is like a 3 spicy, and just like throw out the spice. And my posts, you know, can range in like spice.
I love that.
I love that. Oh my gosh.
Do you do like a count with the peppers on there? Like with the emojis? So
if we use Slack, which we don't, we had built custom Slack emojis with the different peppers. So you could be like, that's a 3 pepper post.
Awesome.
Unfortunately, these teams here.
Yeah. And they got rid of the best emoji on Teams. They used to have this emoji on Teams where it was like a little kissy face emoji that was putting on lipstick like this.
Oh.
And my team loved that emoji and they got rid of it. And we still talk about it to this day.
Disappointing.
Allison, if you're listening, this is for you.